Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up next hour, Bernadette Peters will be live with us. She has three concerts at the Pasadena Civic coming up. Not just that, she's back in a big show later this year, a show of Sondheim compositions on the West End in London. So much going on in her life. She shows no signs whatsoever of slowing down, and we'll talk with her about her extraordinary career. That's next hour. But we begin with a study published today in the journal Nature. It comes from scientists at San Diego State University collaborating with UC San Diego Scripps Institution of Oceanography. The study finding that as the Salton Sea has dried up over time, it appears to have stabilized the southern section of the San Andreas Fault, perhaps explaining at least in part why there's been a delay in the anticipated big one, that massive earthquake with close to magnitude 8 on the Richter scale that is anticipated and that is expected to lead to widespread damage and deaths. Joining us to talk about the study from San Diego State, co-author of the study, Assistant Professor of Geological Sciences, Matt Weingarten. Professor Weingarten, thank you very much for joining us. Let's look back a little bit historically at the Salton Basin, where Lake Kaweah, historically far bigger, what, six times by surface area bigger than the Salton Sea, 40 times by volume bigger than what we have known in recent times as the Salton Sea was there. What do we understand historically about activity on the southern San Andreas versus what we've seen in more recent decades?
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for having me on. We learned in this study, there were two major findings. We used the historical record from paleoseismic evidence and paleolake evidence in the Salton Trough to document that six of the past seven major earthquakes on the southern San Andreas Fault, we're talking magnitude 7 and above, occurred when hydraulic loads from Lake Kaweah were present in the Salton Trough. And as you said, Lake Kaweah was very large, 40 times larger than the modern day Salton Sea by volume, six times larger by surface area.
And how did that process work? So all that water that's there, in what way did it put pressure on the fault, leading the fault to slip more easily? And how much involved the porousness of water getting down deeper into where essentially it lubricates the fault?
Yeah, so the second major finding is that causal relationship. Essentially, we have the correlation from the empirical evidence. And the second major part of this study was building computational models to explain the physics of this process. And that was an extremely important piece of this study because it allowed us to document that the stresses on the southern San Andreas Fault were actually promoted failure when the hydraulic load was present.
Lake Kaweah that we were just talking about filled six times in the last 1,000 years as the Colorado River flooded. That's what's happened historically. This, even prior to the early 20th century, human-caused event with the breach that created our modern-day Salton Sea. This goes back far further than that, where you had what was a natural overflow of the Colorado River to fill up the basin with this huge volume of water. And so you were actually able to determine, Professor, that there was a corresponding, as the weight of the water, the volume of the water was higher, that there were significantly more movement episodes on the San Andreas.
Yes, so we have the empirical evidence for that from the paleoseismic record. What the additional part of the study was the physics-based model that helped us compute the stresses on the Southern San Andreas Fault. This is really a state-of-the-art model run on the fastest supercomputers. The whole suite of models took 5 weeks to run. It really wasn't practical to run these types of models even maybe as recently as 20 years ago. And there are two major ways in which the stresses on the Southern San Andreas are altered by the hydraulic load of ancient Lake Kahia. The first is exactly what you described before. It's the physical weight of the water. That happens almost instantaneously. As the lake fills, it takes a long time to actually fill the lake. It takes about anywhere between 14 to 18 years of Colorado River flow into this region to fill the full extent of the lake. That weight actually bends the Earth's crust, kind of like a plastic ruler bending in your hands if you squeeze it. That happens almost instantaneously. The second piece is a more delayed effect, where the actual pressure of the water actually diffuses down into the fault zone and gets to the depth of where we think earthquakes can nucleate on the Southern San Andreas Fault. That process can take several years to, more, a decade, depends on certain conditions within the fault zone.
So as the Salton Sea has shrunk and there's much less of that pressure, we've gone through this comparatively quiet period. It's about 180 years between major earthquakes that we saw over the last 1,000 years. And now it's been more than 300 years since we've had a major quake on the Southern San Andreas, essentially from Salton Sea up to the San Bernardino Mountains. Now, does that mean once that rupture finally happens, once the two plates as they go alongside each other do slip, that we're apt for a much bigger earthquake than one would have seen, say 700 years ago, when you were getting more frequent quakes along the fault?
Yeah, so our calculations of stress changes from the hydrologic load are superimposing on the existing plate tectonic loads. So plate tectonics is happening all the time. It's loading faults all around the world, including the Southern San Andreas Fault. And the hydraulic load in the historical cases that we've documented was superimposing on top of that load. So it was an additional load on top of the plate tectonic load. Now that we haven't had essentially a major hydraulic load like ancient Lake Kahia in the last 300 years. The last major rupture was in the 1720s. That was the last time that the lake was high. It's been 300 years since the last major event. We think this study shows that in part, some of the superimposed stresses from previous lakes is no longer there. But I will say that plate tectonics is still operating. And that's the main contribution of stress to the overall fault. The longer we know from earthquake physics, the longer you build up stress and strain on a fault, on a major fault, without having an earthquake, the higher the chance of that major earthquake in the future.
So it's in a sense good news, bad news. So the good news, as Salton Sea is smaller, we've gone 300 years without a major quake on that stretch of the fault. The bad news is when it does happen, it's got a lot of pent-up stress from not having had an earthquake for 300 years.
I think that's fair to say. Yep.
And what, if any, implications are there for filling up more of the Salton Sea? Of course, this is a very important waterway for birds, for many species of fowl. It's part of their seasonal corridor that they use. Environmentalists very concerned. Plus, if the lake were to go dry, you'd have all the toxic soil there that's exposed, creating dust clouds over much of Imperial Valley and the Coachella Valley. So what, if any, implications are there for what's the best amount of water to keep in Salton Sea to serve both the wildlife needs and air quality standards, but also make it in some ways earthquake protective?
Yeah, so I don't think our study directly answers that question. What I will say is that we did consider a model that included the breach of the irrigation channels that filled the Salton Sea back in the early part of the 20th century, and the contribution of those stresses from that lake load, the bigger version of the Salton Sea, were relatively small. Remember, ancient Lake Kihia was 40 times bigger than the modern extent of the Salton Sea. So we're talking about kind of like a drop in the bucket in the context of the modern day Salton Trough and the modern day Southern San Andreas.
Professor, so sorry that I need to wrap up, but thank you so much. We really appreciate you being with us talking about this study that was just published just about an hour ago. That's San Diego State University Assistant Professor of Geological Sciences, Matt Weingarten, co-author of the study published in the journal Nature.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
For many years on Air Talk, we have been debating the idea of congestion pricing. You've probably heard that term. It means for driving certain stretches of roads or certain geographic regions of cities, you pay a price to do so. The idea is to cut down on congestion and to encourage people to use alternative forms of transit, often public transit if it's a city that has a particularly strong such system, or bicycle riding or walking or finding other ways to do that. London, Stockholm, Beijing, those are among the cities that have introduced congestion pricing as a way of trying to reduce traffic and to encourage mass transit. Well, a long-awaited study looking at the potential for congestion pricing experiments in the LA metro area will be published later this summer. There are three potential zones that are being looked at, including the Santa Monica Freeway between Santa Monica and downtown L.A., also areas traversing West Los Angeles to the San Fernando Valley, and a portion of downtown Los Angeles. Those are all in the mix. The question, of course, is with public transit ridership down in the metro system amidst concerns about people having encounters with people who are antisocial or threats that might be made when taking public transit, is it a viable alternative in the LA metro area? Joining us, Executive Officer of Innovation at LA Metro, Mark Valinatos. He's overseeing the feasibility of this study at Metro. Mark, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it. I assume when this study started, it was at a very different time where the future of public transit looked great. Now, of course, we're in a time where public transit is reeling. And I wonder how, if at all, that changes what's going to be presented.
Well, thanks, Larry, for including us in this conversation. Metro has a plan to help people get around LA County, and studying the way that pricing can help reduce congestion in some of the most traffic clogged parts of the county, as you described, is part of that plan. But so is our other work in terms of planning and opening new rail lines, trying to get better bus service, listening to our riders to improve customer experience. And the reason we're looking at pricing is it's really the only proven way to reduce congestion, because congestion and traffic jams happen when too many people are on the same road at the same time. If you give a little signal to them through pricing, just a small portion of them need to decide not to drive at that exact time, and that'll free up space for other people. And to your point of, has the world changed? Yes, it has. In fact, this study started just before the pandemic. We did initial analysis of the areas that you mentioned. And then because of some of the transportation changes that happened during COVID and afterwards, in terms of more work from home, for example, we recently did a second round of modeling, looking at how the traffic flow changes might impact the results. And also we use that as an opportunity to see what would happen if we would exempt some low-income drivers from having to pay, and some sort of HOV situations where there's multiple drivers in a car.
Now, I would assume that, I mean, this is something that even for a pilot program, because you're talking about not just a single lane that would be, you know, given over to pricing for a speed advantage, like Fast Track. This is something where all the lanes, let's say you did the pilot on the 10 freeway between Santa Monica and downtown, all the lanes would be, at least for certain hours, subject to having to pay to use the freeway. And you would expect significant pushback to that. But now that so many people have safety concerns because of people dealing with severe mental illness on light rail and buses and the like, people using the public transit system for shelter, I would expect you're going to get even more pushback to this because so many people don't feel safe now taking public transit. How are you anticipating, you know, before that issue is resolved with public transit, getting buy-in from the public on this?
Yes. I mean, this study is meant to look at the feasibility of congestion pricing plus reinvesting any net revenues in transportation improvements. And all along, it's been based on the idea that we'll be going out to the public, to stakeholders, to our board, to get their input so we can present the best possible alternative to our board. And if our board decides to move a concept forward, it would not launch immediately. It would move into a longer period of much more detailed environmental review and program design. But in terms of people maybe pushing back, we can think about it on the flip side, that do people like getting stuck in traffic, right? Do you like having time taken from us when we're in a jam and travel time is unreliable and it's really stressful? And so you think about some of the main beneficiaries of trying congestion pricing would be people driving. Because again, if people who really don't need to be on the road at that time decide to shift when they drive, if I need to go somewhere important, I suddenly would get increased speed. I would get less delay. I would get minutes back into my life that I could spend with my family or friends or work or whatever I need to do. So there can be some big benefits for people who drive. And also, we do care as a transportation agency about the bus riders and people on rail and people who are using public transportation. And we think that, first of all, there are people who are riding the bus who are stuck on the same roadways. And so speeding up some of those corridors would help them get where they need to go to. And again, we could also reinvest funds in improving those options so that people who don't want to drive alone would have better experience. And that can include addressing our customers' concerns about the status of rail, for example. It could be more frequency of buses. It could be bus lanes. It could be a whole host of things that make it easier to go through those areas.
And is part of the study looking at what the cost would be, say, to retail products? Because if you've got truck drivers and delivery drivers who are subject to this as well, presumably there'd be some effect on the cost of the goods being delivered and on delivery charges. So is that factored in as well?
We've looked at freight traffic using some of the same sort of modeling systems to see what might happen. I don't think there'd be a major impact from a delivery truck paying a small charge in an area. But the good news is we're going out soon to share the results, early results of our modeling. And part of that is conversations with stakeholders. So that could be businesses, that could be transportation companies, that can be shop owners. And as I mentioned, that can also be people riding buses. That can be people who've been suffering from air pollution from living near crowded, you know, freeways and major roadways. So we'll get everyone's input and try to design pilot concepts that would maximize the benefits of rear flowing roads, time savings, less pollution, giving people more access to more jobs in the same amount of time, and also addressing any concerns people have about impacts.
We're talking with Mark Valianatos, who is Executive Officer of Innovation at LA County Metro. He's overseeing the feasibility study on congestion pricing. Later this year, it'll be introduced and there'll be public feedback on this, a proposal for one of three areas to be tested for congestion pricing to see what the response is. Does it drive greater usage of public transit? Does it cause people to shift the hours in which they're out using those corridors to free up during those peak times? We'll find out more about that. I'd like to hear your thoughts. We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and your first name. Also with us, the Executive Director of the Southern California Association of Governments, which does planning and research on many issues of counties and cities' importance. Joining us is Kome Ajisa. Thank you so much for joining us, Kome. We appreciate it. Your thoughts about the feasibility of doing congestion pricing in parts of LA County?
Oh, thank you for inviting us, Larry. The feasibility work that LA Metro is doing, I think it's really important, and it's an important next step to looking for solutions to the sort of perennial issue that we have in Southern California and many other places. Congestion pricing is something we had been looking at SCAG for a number of years. In fact, in 2019, we did a sort of a small area feasibility analysis of congestion pricing and found it to be promising in addressing the issues of congestion in our area. And, you know, it's not just congestion that ultimately is the benefit. I mean, that's the main driver. You're trying to manage demand on the system and optimize the use of the system. But it also has other co-benefits that come from that. You had asked Mark about the potential of impact on goods, the cost of goods that are moved in a congestion pricing environment. But we have to keep in mind those goods are stuck in traffic right now. So we're paying a premium for what it cost to have them stuck in traffic already. So to be able to free those up, you'll probably see more of a net gain in those areas. So that's just an example of some of the side benefits that I'm expecting that the feasibility will show that LA Metro is working on.
We'll continue our conversation with the Executive Director of the Southern California Association of Governments, known as SCAG, Kome Ajisa, joining us along with Mark Valianatos of LA Metro, and soon to be with us from Occidental College, Seva Rodnianski will be with us to talk about how this affects the urban environment.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
We're talking about congestion pricing. In the future, there might be an experiment here in Los Angeles County to take a region of the city, charge people during peak times to use that corridor, with the idea of getting people to drive when they can in off-peak times, to use alternate forms of transportation like public transit or riding a bicycle or walking. All of this with the idea of trying to change our patterns and to get a bit more free flow on the roadways. There are three areas of Los Angeles that are up for consideration. One is a central part of downtown Los Angeles. Another are the corridor that traverses West Los Angeles to the San Fernando Valley. And a third is the 10 Santa Monica Freeway from downtown Los Angeles to Santa Monica. Now, this isn't going to happen tomorrow. This is all up for public input once the full report is released a bit later this year. And we're talking with the gentleman who's overseeing this feasibility study for LA Metro, Mark Valianatos, also with us from the Southern California Association of Governments, Executive Director Kome Ajise, and joining us from Occidental College, Assistant Professor of Urban and Environmental Policy, Seva Rodniansky. Thank you so much, Professor Rodniansky, for joining us. We appreciate it. Looking at the cities where this has apparently worked to cut down on traffic in peak times, are they comparable to Los Angeles and the alternatives available to us here, and where the central transit, the terminus of transit points are, is that comparable to cities like London?
Thank you, Larry. Great to be here. Great question. So as Mark had said earlier, congestion pricing is something definitely that works to reduce congestion. And the three kind of best-known examples are London, Singapore, and Stockholm. And in each of those, over long periods, we've seen about a 10 to 30% reduction in congestion and a 10 to 30% increase in speeds for those who are still driving. They've also found that buses run faster in those areas, and mostly those who shifted away from driving, about half switched to public transit, at least in London and Stockholm. And in Singapore, it was mostly toward large four-plus person carpools, almost a van pool. So in terms of working, in those examples, it's certainly a proven model. But as you said, LA is different, and overall transit usage, pre-program, is lower in LA than it is in those areas. LA is also a much larger and much more polycentric city, which means that there's, people are going to multiple places. They're not just going downtown LA. They're not just going downtown Santa Monica. And I think one thing to consider that hasn't yet been brought up is in these three zones, right, downtown LA, along the I-10 between downtown and Santa Monica, and in the Sepulveda Pass along I-405 and Sepulveda Boulevard, these are different. A few of these are kind of core destinations that are well served by existing transit in LA. Downtown is actually one of the best, most transit viable places we have in the LA region, with both rail, bus, rapid bus, commuter bus, bike lanes as well. And along the I-10, similarly, there's the Expo Line and Express and local buses. In the Sepulveda Pass, however, there's really not as many viable alternatives, although they are planned, there's plans for rail in the future. So currently, the way that the way that your drivers are going to make different types of decisions depending on where they are, and especially pass-through drivers, right? People who are going, let's say, from the San Fernando Valley, perhaps to the South Bay or to Long Beach, they won't have as many options, or they'll have to perhaps pay the congestion charge, whereas somebody who's going directly downtown or to downtown Santa Monica, they may elect to carpool or to take transit, and that's a much more viable alternative for them.
Greg in Sherman Oaks says, I have a lot of problems with this. It affects poor people more than those with money, and everyone is going to use the canyon roads as alternatives. So what is the effect going to be on those roads? Greg really commenting on the Sepulveda Pass as being a potential zone where congestion pricing could be tried. Peter in Pasadena says, if this happens, there'll be a lot of us taking the surface streets to bypass freeways. And then what happens to the carpool lanes? Would those be charged as well? Yes, presumably, Peter, this would take over all lanes. Mark, is that right? There wouldn't continue to be carpool lanes under this, an area that's under a pilot project, would it? Mark, you there? Yeah, go ahead.
Broadly speaking, the goal would be to price all lanes during the peak times in those areas. Just to comment on the Sepulveda, the comment from the viewer, from the listener on Sepulveda, the concept we're looking at actually prices three freeways and the canyon arterial roads as well. So there would not be spillover traffic. There'd be a broader zone to avoid that. In terms of the 10, it would just be the 10. And the concept we're looking at for downtown would be the roadways crossing over the freeway ring and potentially also parts of the freeways kind of extending around downtown.
Frank in Pasadena says, the number one issue, people don't feel safe riding Metro. It's the overwhelming concern in every survey right now. That is the top priority that needs to be addressed. We have Scott in West LA. Congestion pricing is another step toward physically separating the wealthy from everyone else. The rules will provide limited exceptions for the poor, further squeeze the middle class, and create spacious entertainment zones for the rich. The answer is to continue to build public transit until it actually provides a faster, more convenient way to get around, rather than penalizing people into a system that is always slower and less convenient. That's Scott in West Los Angeles. Professor Rodniansky, your response to that?
I think those are all very relevant points. I do want to point out that, the equity considerations right now from a congestion pricing scheme, like the people that might be most affected by the pricing would be, low-income car-dependent drivers who don't have a viable transit or walking or biking alternative. That said, though, current carless low-income households who are on the transit system are often an even greater disadvantage, right? And drivers as a whole group roads are subsidized at a higher level than transit. So in some ways, this is kind of leveling the playing field. And if congestion pricing is able to shift a greater portion of, people of all incomes toward existing transit and the kind of program expansions that Metro has in plan for the next several decades, that could significantly go toward exactly what the listener is saying.
Jack in Los Angeles says, will the revenue raised be used to offset existing taxes, or is this just a revenue grab and will voters have a say? Mark?
It's definitely not a revenue grab. The goal of the pricing system, which would be dynamic, so it would be different amounts at different times of the day, so that, again, we're trying to adjust just enough drivers to make the roads work better, would be to then, so we're not trying to raise a certain amount of money, we're just trying to set the price as low as is needed to have better flowing roads. And then we'd reinvest it to address all the issues that have been discussed in terms of giving better alternatives to people in those corridors or those areas. And again, that can be more bus service, that can be new services, that can be, bus and bike lanes to help people move quicker and safer. It can be road safety enhancements, because we know that residents of low-income communities suffer the greatest from unsafe streets. So And it could also be low-income assistance programs so that low-income drivers who do need to use the roads can get where they need to go.
Would this go before voters, or you just take public input at meetings and make a decision without voters casting a ballot on it?
It would go through a number of political steps. It would go to our metro board first, and if they advance it, then there'd be discussions at the state level whether there needs to be authorizing legislation, so elected officials would address that. And we'd also need to talk to the federal government, as New York City just did, in terms of can we get do an environmental process at the federal level and get permission to do some kind of pricing.
Thank you very much for joining us. That's Executive Officer of Innovation for LA Metro, Mark Valianatos. Our thanks to Komi Ajise and to Seva Rodnayansky joining us from Occidental College. It's Air Talk.
Want bread and respect and attention, not to say connection. Modeling's no profession. If you want instead, when you're dead, some more public and more permanent expression of affection, you want a painter, poet, sculptor, preferably marble, granite, bronze, durable, something nice with swans that's durable forever.
The wonderful voice and interpretive skills of the great Bernadette Peters, who joins us this morning again on Air Talk, three-time Tony Award recipient, often called Broadway's leading lady for decades. She has performed on stage with the works of America's greatest, including Stephen Sondheim, of course, and Andrew Lloyd Webber, but not just stage, of course, multiple film and television roles, most recently in High Desert. Patricia Arquette, the star that series, just with us last week on Air Talk, and Bernadette Peters plays her mother in that series, which is out now and streaming on Apple TV Plus. Bernadette Peters, it's a pleasure to have you back with us on Air Talk.
Oh, thank you, Larry. I'm so happy to be here with you.
First of all, you have three performances coming up Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the gorgeous Pasadena Civic Auditorium. And this part of the Pasadena Playhouse's Sondheim celebration. Tell us a little bit about what those concert performances will be providing.
Well, the whole season at the Pasadena Playhouse was doing a whole season of Stephen Sondheim shows, ending with me at the Civic Auditorium doing a whole concert of Stephen Sondheim's music. So, I mean, I do things that people expect, and then I do things that people don't expect, because I love his music so much. I ended up singing everybody else's songs that are in the show, not my songs, because I sit in the wings and I fall in love with all the music. So it's some expected things and some unexpected things will be happening.
What was your personal relationship like with Stephen Sondheim, given all the collaborations that you had with him over the years?
You know, I really just, I just adored him. I would call him for advice. He also was so funny. He just used to say things that I just would be, I'd be in stitches. He was just so funny. I don't want to say clever, witty. He was funny. And I just appreciated that so much in him. He also had a big heart. He also loved animals. He loved dogs. And of course, that's my passion, is saving dogs in from shelters. So I miss him greatly, because I used to call him up for advice all the time. Mm-hmm. I was so privileged and to be able to be in his shows and to be able to sing his music.
Well, and when you're on stage this weekend doing these performances, you feel in a sense like, because so much of his work has so much of himself in it, in a sense like he's with you with that?
Oh, my goodness, yes. You know, we actually did a concert in London honoring him and raising money for his foundation. He was so there, and he'll be there. He'll be with me. Yeah, he'll be with all of us in the audience that loves him, and me on the stage loving him.
Mm-hmm. Also, very good news for the Pasadena Playhouse. The producing artistic director, Danny Feldman, and the Playhouse winning a special Tony Award for regional theater, which is great news. The Playhouse having just a tremendous year, particularly with the Sondheim Festival that's going on. Bernadette Peters, who joins us, a part of it with these three big events in the 3,000-seat Pasadena Civic Auditorium, Friday night at 8 o'clock, Saturday night at 8 o'clock, Sunday afternoon at 2. Tickets are available as well as information by going to PasadenaPlayhouse.org, and tickets can be purchased at Ticketmaster. You mentioned your love for dogs, and you co-founded, as I recall, with Mary Tyler Moore, the Broadway Barks dog adoption program. Do you have one of those events coming up soon?
Oh, yes, it'll be, I can't even believe it, 25 years. And Mary and I started that because of our love for animals 25 years ago. And we will have that. Broadway Barks will be in Schubert Alley, July 8th. And it's become, belongs to the Broadway community now. And they all come out from between shows and meet their animals and get some pet therapy and bring them up on stage and talk about them. And this season, this year, Randy Rainbow is going to be co-hosting with me, and he also wrote a song for us that we're going to be doing in the show. That'll be a lot of fun.
Very good. That's Broadway Barks coming up in July. And I also understand you're going to be on the West End. I don't know when the last time you were there. Cameron McIntosh production of Old Friends, a great big Broadway show as it's built. Stephen Sondheim's music, all-star cast, including yourself and Leah Salonga, at the Gielgud Theater, that coming up in September. Share with us a little bit about that and playing the West End versus playing Broadway. When's the last time you were in London to perform?
Well, I've never played the West End.
Never?
Wow. No, I've never done a show. I've been there doing concerts. And last time I did a concert was a number of years ago there. But I actually was there last May doing this wonderful Stephen Sondheim tribute with Dame Judi Dench and Petula Clark and Imelda Staunton. That was just in the one dressing room. Julia McKenzie. It was just a thrill to be in that dressing room. And Cameron loved the show so much, she decided now to present it with a reduced cast, but many, many stars from the West End, and myself and Leah Salonga. And it's going to be thrilling to just do all of Steve's music and songs that I've sung and songs that I haven't sung. It's fun because I get to play one of the three strippers, actually Mazeppa, in Gypsy.
That's great. And are you committed to all 16 weeks of the production there?
Yes, absolutely. I'm there the whole time.
That's great. Bernadette Peters joining us again. She's on stage singing her heart out, as she always does, Friday and Saturday night and Sunday afternoon at the Pasadena Civic Auditorium. This is a Pasadena Playhouse production, a part of the Sondheim celebration, and of course the much larger house needed for fans of Bernadette Peters to perform in concert over the course of this weekend. You've had such a long career, from being a child actor through your teen years and all the different phases of your career involving film and television and stage work. And over the period of time and all the things that you've learned, all the talents that you've worked with over those years, is it at all different when you get on stage, the feelings that you have before you, say, walk out on stage at the Pasadena Civic, than when, say, you were a 20-year-old getting set to step out onto a Broadway stage?
Yes, very different. You've lived that many years longer. You've learned that much more. You have such great material now to bring, because I did Sunday in the Park, I did Into the Woods, and Steve wrote all those shows that I could pull material from. So I know that I'm out there presenting material that I connect with so deeply, and that the audience, if I connect to it, the audience certainly will connect to it. and presenting a show that I love and that I, so part of it is knowing that you're connecting so strongly with the material. And that's wonderful. So there's more, a bit more confidence and security that way.
I'd also have to think it's different when you were lesser known and starting out, that experience coming out on stage when really it's all about, you know, what talent are you bringing to the performance. Now you step on stage and it's not just the immediate experience that people are having a positive reaction to, but to all that you've given them over the years as well, all that pent up wellspring of goodwill towards you. And what does that feel like?
That's remarkable when the audience is letting you know as soon as you come out how much they appreciate what you've been bringing to them all those years. And but you know, we're in the moment, and that moment is the most important thing. So that night I'm also bringing them the importance of each song and the moment of each song, and we're having that experience together. So I am bringing my, I don't know what to call it, talent, but my depth of creativity and what I feel is going on in each song and the moment, every, you know, these moments, the most important moments.
And everyone right. is fresh. And that, I assume, is part of what makes it exciting for you to continue to perform, is every interpretation is fresh. Bernadette Peters, thank you so much for joining us on Air Talk again today. Congratulations on all, you're so busy, all the projects you've got going, and this hugely popular series coming up this weekend. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you, Larry.
Appreciate it. Bernadette Peters, we go out listening to Children Will Listen. This from Live in Carnegie Hall 2005 from Into the Woods, Stephen Sondheim, composer.
Not free.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. A very good Wednesday to you. I'm Larry Mantle. We are just at the halfway point of this June member drive in terms of Air Talk, so thank you so much. We really appreciate your generous support. You know, for those that are dealing with cancer, the term battle or fight against cancer has been a part of our culture for a very long time. You'll hear this frequently with newscasters using the term lost a fight against cancer, lost a battle against cancer. But there are those who don't like that terminology. It actually goes back at least to 1971 and President Nixon then famously declaring a war on cancer. But a study back in 2019 found that patients who were exposed to using those terms about their cancer had more fearful and fatalistic attitudes toward it. Now, could it be that the language is the cause for that? Joining us is Dr. Sunita Puri, who is Program Director of the Hospice and Palliative Medicine Fellowship at the University of Massachusetts. Dr. Puri is author of That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour. Dr. Puri, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Larry. It's a real honor to talk with you about this very important topic.
So I have friends who have used this terminology to describe their own, whatever you want to call it, if in their case, battle against cancer, or they're going to fight as hard as they can to try and beat the odds of cancer. I assume you don't have any problem with people who choose to use this about their own cancer journey. Is that correct?
Oh, certainly. And I think, you know, we can talk about the ways that those words might feel not really fair or appropriate to some people. But I also think that if people adopt language that feels true to them and that helps them, that we certainly can respect that.
All right. What are your concerns about using it as a common term in public for dealing with cancer?
So I think the term fighter, kind of like the phrase, I want everything done, or I'm waiting for a miracle. These are words that are kind of stand-ins for much bigger conversations about what these terms mean to somebody. So for example, if someone tells me in a conversation that they are going to fight or battle cancer, or that they're a fighter, I ask them what that means to them. Tell me what being a fighter means and looks like to you. Tell me what you understand about this battle. Because I think if we excavate the meaning of the word, we're actually getting to what people are trying to say. And when we use words like this, we're kind of also setting up people with cancer into the categories of winners and losers. So if you win a battle, then you've done a good job. If you lose a battle, it's almost implied that it was you rather than your body coming to a natural limit. And that's a distinction I think is very important for people to hear and understand, that you may be a fighter in the ways you choose to define that. But so much of what happens with cancer and other illnesses is that your body reaches a limit, and it might be your body that can't fight anymore. So the term itself, while well-intentioned in its use by some people and certainly very common, I think it unfortunately places a tremendous amount of personal responsibility on a patient without really regard to the fact that sometimes what happens with cancer has nothing to do with that person.
That's so interesting, because I wouldn't have assumed if someone said, I'm fighting cancer, I'm battling cancer, that that meant that they felt it was a moral failing or they didn't do enough if they succumbed to cancer. That's not necessarily implied, because we take on all kinds of battles. We know we might not win, and that we can't fully control all the variables. But you're saying in this case, for some people, when they say that, it's like they're taking this on, in a sense, to judge themselves negatively if their life isn't prolonged as long as possible, or their death is not as peaceful as possible.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, another term that comes up quite often in conversations is the term strong, or getting stronger. So I'll commonly hear oncologists say to a patient, when you get stronger, we can get you chemotherapy. And I think people really take that on as a personal failing if they can't get stronger, with stronger not always being clearly defined. And so people sometimes feel that if they don't push themselves to get out of bed, even when they don't have the energy or they're in too much pain to do so, that they are not getting stronger and making the effort that they need to demonstrate to get more therapy. But again, strength of spirit is not the same as strength of the body. And so that's something that, you know, again, can be interpreted as a person just not trying hard enough or not wanting to live badly enough to take on what at that point might be too much for their body. And so I think, you know, these concepts of being a fighter or getting stronger, what I wish we could also talk about is the concepts of suffering and dignity. Because those are things that are absent largely from discussions about what it means to be sick, what it means to be alive, actually. And I think if we reintroduce a softer and more compassionate, humanistic vocabulary to these discussions, then I think we can actually help people to understand that fighting at all costs may not actually be what they really mean. They're telling us that they're fighters.
We're talking with Dr. Sunitha Puri, who is Program Director of the Hospice and Palliative Medicine Fellowship at UMass and author of That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour. I'm interested in hearing your thoughts for Dr. Puri. We're at 866-893-5722. Dr. Puri, the other thing is that, you know, often physicians will want to exhaust every possible avenue for treatment, even if maybe the quality of life is going to suffer as a result of that. Like, well, if we can get the patient a couple more months, they may be hellish months, but, you know, we can get a couple more months. And not all patients necessarily want to go down that road. You think that this language kind of feeds that sort of do whatever you can to prolong life at all costs?
I think that so I'm going to give you a personal example where when I was in my residency, if a patient told me that they were a fighter, then my assumption was that they would want to go through any and all treatments, no matter what the cost to their dignity and their suffering and their quality of life. And I think, unfortunately, in medicine, instead of breaking that word down, we attach our own assumptions to what somebody may be trying to tell us. So if we have the impression, or if a physician has the impression that someone is a fighter and willing to go through anything, then I think the conversation about what other options exist and the interrogation of what quality of life this person would actually want and whether these treatments can help them achieve that, that kind of falls by the wayside. If we're given a certain impression, but also if we don't know and don't have the training to get into the bigger discussion of what someone wants their life to look like and what they're actually fighting for.
Dr. Puri, please hold that thought. We have Leah with us in Ojai. Leah, I understand that you're being treated for cancer. Please share your thoughts about this.
I'm not being treated for cancer right now. I was treated for breast cancer a couple of years ago.
Oh, okay.
But this still resonated very much with me because I was almost surprised with what the doctor had to say. For me, it was incredibly important to see myself as a fighter, to focus on my strength, to say, okay, I'm not going neatly into this. I am, you know, I'm going to, well, what I was fighting for was my quality of life. And So I could not align myself with what the doctor was saying at all. It's almost surprising to me.
Mm-hmm. Leah, I appreciate it. Dr. Puri, you want to respond to what Leah is saying?
So I think, Leah, that it can be really empowering to use the terminology that you're using. And I'm so glad that that worked for you. And I think it's just a matter of it being not as useful for some people, and people might interpret it in a different way when it's used to describe them or when they feel like they need to say that they're a fighter to get through something. But I think cancer and any sort of illness is such an individual experience that we bring to it the full force of our lives and our personalities. And so bringing your strengths to that is probably played a huge role in your healing.
Well, and the other thing that Leah was saying was that she was really fighting for quality of life, which I thought was interesting. And so if her doctor would have interpreted as I'm fighting for to exist at any means possible, that's not what she was saying. She had a very clear idea of what it meant to her to fight for her best interests. Leah, I so appreciate your call, and thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Puri, we appreciate your being with us today on Air Talk.
Thank you so much, Larry.
Thank you. That's Dr. Sunitha Puri of University of Massachusetts, author of That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Thank you if you've supported and had your contribution matched. You mean the world to us. We really, really appreciate it. Well, as you know, during our member drives, we celebrate the backbone of LAS 89.3. These individuals who you don't typically hear their names on the air, you certainly don't hear them at a microphone, but they are absolutely integral to what we do in providing you with the programming that you appreciate so much. Joining us is a beloved member of our team here at LAS.com, so widely respected and appreciated for all that she does with the client members with whom she works, Catherine Gefeller, LAS Senior Major Gifts Officer. Catherine, it's great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. I'm glad to be here.
So describe briefly your work and what you do with those who are considering or are making a planned gift.
We encourage our listeners to consider including LAS in their plans and then also to let us know about that, much as you did, Larry, when you recently became a member of the Legacy yeah. Society. And there are a variety of aspects of making a plan. We'd love to know what supporters are thinking of just to make sure that we can implement it and that they're making a gift that's meaningful to them. It really sustains the future of the service. So.
And I would think that, you know, part of it is people asking, well, what are the long-term plans for the organization? What is the mission? And kind of, you know, like on job interviews, where do you see yourself as an organization? So part of it, I assume, is telling people, here's what our plans are and here's why your gift that we may not get for 10 or 20 years is important.
Right. And that matchmaking of a person's individual interest, what they're most passionate about with LAS service, and helping to make sure their plans are going to do exactly what they're imagining.
All right. We'll get back to Catherine Gefeller, LAS Senior Major Gifts Officer. Donald Paz is an audio engineer at LAS. Donald, thanks so much. I know you're a big sports fan too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Big baseball lover, as many of us are here at LAS. Donald, tell us a little bit about the projects you work on.
So I work currently right now with LAS Studios, which is our podcast department. And we just recently just finished Wild, I Think I'm Falling in Love. I know Eric and Megan were on Air Talk a couple weeks ago. And it's been a lot of fun just working on that show and just like what the meaning of the show is and how it just the stuff that we're doing here at LAS Studios is just really, really good. It's really well curated. And I really love just the team, the people, the stories, just everything that we're doing. It's just so great. And I'm the guy that basically gets the episode before the listener listens to it. So all the effects, all the everything that you hear, the cleanliness of the audio and vocals and everything, I'm the guy that touches it. So I'm the last one before you get to hear it.
It's a very creative process, isn't
it? It is. It's a mixture of both creative and kind of like when
detail
you hear those effects
work,
and all that. Yeah, because you're trying to tell a story, so invoking the emotion and everything. So that, and then also just on the scientific side, just making sure like everything sounds clean, there's good compression on the vocals and EQing, and it's all like a lot of the nerdy like kind of audio engineering stuff, but it's so much fun for me. But I'm just very, very grateful to be able to do this kind of work. So.
That's great. And you help us on Air Talk if we
Yes, I did.
If Evelyn's not available,
exactly.
you'll come in, and we've worked together on mm-hmm. election nights, haven't
yes,
we?
Yes, election night, like yeah, that. Recently,
so,
yeah.
So that's been good. We're talking with Donald Paz, who's an audio engineer for LAS Studios, and you, like me, started as an intern at PCC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you're far younger than me, but still, you know, kind of speaks to that opportunity to get the experience yes. here, show what you can do as mm-hmm. you did, and get
yeah.
hired.
Yeah, exactly. My internship experience was great. I loved it. I knew when I got here, like I was gonna love it, just because of the vibe everywhere with everyone and just the workflow. I mean, I come from doing music production independently, so I've always loved audio. And that was, I think, my thing. Like, I love audio a lot. So when I was here, I was making it a point to really learn the mixing tools and everything. So I got on, did radio as an intern, you know, worked myself to kind of be on staff. And then, worked weekends, worked overnights. I, you know, loved everything. I loved all the shifts. And then eventually being able to work on Air Talk was really good. So it's been fun. And I've had a lot of fun doing it. And I really appreciate all the work that we do here and just how we, you know, we're the guys behind the scenes and we don't get seen a lot, but also like we're the ones that help make the ship run. So.
Well, and I just want to say that the team that's here, and I include Evelyn in this, and
yeah.
I'm going to leave people out, but Sean and I mean, all, yeah. We have so many great. This team is really remarkable. You've maybe worked in other places where you've seen the commitment people have here on the technical side. And I talk to colleagues at other stations, and they don't have the same story. This is really a tight and dedicated team.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a lot to our leadership. That's definitely, we're very tight knit. Like all the engineers are really tight knit, and we really do a good job of communicating with each other. Whatever one lacks, the other one makes up for it, and we really help each other in that regard. So it's been really cool to be able to just be in a place where that exists, because similar to you, I've heard stories about in other places where it's really tough.
Yeah,
you
people really, kind of mail in you the fight work, for and your that spot. Never happened. Yeah,
exactly.
And here, everybody's like, and I've been fortunate with every engineer that I've had on Air Talk, including Evelyn. They are so dedicated and just, I mean, there every day and focused.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. We help each other a lot. Like, I know a lot of people don't know this, but like we really do communicate really well with each other. We help each other out. If there's something that we don't know, we ask, and we really teach each other a lot of things. So,
well, that's got to be part of the fun, because it's a business that's constantly changing.
Exactly.
That's what I love about, I'm learning all the time. And on the technical side, you have to, because it's changing so fast.
Exactly.
We're talking with Donald Paz, who's audio engineer for LAS. Catherine Geffeller, major gifts here, the senior major gifts officer at LAS. So, Catherine, for people who are considering becoming members of our Legacy Society, how do they do that?
Yep. So we have a great web page. It's at laist.com/legacy. It has information on sample language that members can use as they're making their plans. They can reach out. I'm here to help. And we definitely advise that they consider talking with an attorney and making plans that really will be durable and meet their objectives. And then they can join the Legacy Society by completing a form. It's not binding, but it lets us know that they're really opting in to join the group. We have events.
Why is it important for people who do this, who put LAist in their will, to let us know about that? Why do you need to know that?
It allows us to include their name on our website or in other materials. Now, if they want to be anonymous or be named, some of our members are wonderful in recording testimonials, which helps to share their story. And we don't want to put people on the air who haven't agreed to that. And it also really builds a community. We have 120 members so far. That is less than 1% of our whole membership. So it also builds a momentum around creating a sustainable situation for the station into the future.
Yeah. Did the pandemic affect at all what you have been doing?
Our sense, and I think other nonprofits as well, people got a little bit more comfortable, unfortunately, with the notion of mortality and saw more of a reason to create plans, not simply a will or trust, but also power of attorney, advanced health directives. So I think it's been helpful, and unfortunately we do all die, and a legacy is a way to tell a story and also to articulate how an individual wants to be remembered. So it's actually a lot of fun to make plans.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it, and thank you for all the great work that you do. Because as is true, whether it's Catherine on the fundraising side and the support that we need financially, or Donald just doing everything to make the listener experience as creatively interesting and as professional as possible, these are folks that make a huge difference in our experience as LAS listeners. We appreciate them very much. Thanks both of you for being with us.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.